Thanks everybody for coming. My name is Tom Tidwell. I'm the chairman of the Buckhead Council of Neighborhoods. Deborah Wathen, our secretary, our treasurer is around here somewhere. This is Gordon Certain. He is our secretary, and he's really the mover and shaker behind BCA. He's one of the founding members, and I couldn't do what I do without his help. And then the gentleman out front is the vice chairman, Ron Brunwall. I'm not going to go through all the formalities. We've got a great lineup of speakers. We've got some note cards. If you have questions, write them down. We'll pick them up here in the meeting. There's also a sheet with a list of questions or issues I sent Dr. Kasarpin, which she probably didn't read because it was 6 or 7 pages long. But it was good. It was cathartic for me because I got to read right now. I'm very happy that we have Dr. Kasarpin. I've seen her speak twice. She's a great speaker. She has an excellent resume. She went to Auburn, which I did, so that's a plus. She went to Harvard, which I didn't, but that's a plus. But not just so much her resume. She's smart as can be. She's a hard worker, and I judge people by how they get things done. And she's been here for 2 months. She's already making changes. I've worked with school council for Morris Brandon and Sutton, and that's what the principals are telling me. I'll tell one short story. I know you didn't want to hear from me, but the principal at Brandon, they had interviewed a teacher that they wanted to hire. They told her, we'll get back to you in 7 to 10 days, because that's the way they get used to do things. And they got back to her within 2 hours and said, go ahead and hire her. So that's part of the change in culture that Dr. Kasarpin had managed in a very short time. So I'm really happy about the direction we're going. Also, before I introduce her, we have board member Cynthia Briscoe Brown, who's at large from our district. Yeah. Matt Westmoreland, who is District 3, but part of his district encompasses Garden Hills Elementary School. And then Nancy Meister, who's District 4, which is most of North Carolina. So, without further ado, I am going to turn this over to Dr. Kasarpin and welcome her. And I look forward to hearing what you have to say.
There's no bells or anything.
We have to play until 8:45.
8:45. Well, good afternoon. Again, thank you for inviting me to come out tonight. My name is Maria Carson, and it's spelled almost exactly the same. So if you ever need to reach out to me, we have a long-standing Atlanta superintendent email address, but that one doesn't necessarily come to my cell phone. So the one they have me hooked up to, in case you just try to need like a quick question or something, and I will not be able to do the 8 pages of reading on my phone. But that email address is MJ Carstarfin, first letter of middle name, and I won't tell you what my middle name is, and Carstarfin, and then the rest of the Atlanta email address. So that's kind of the fastest way to get me if you need to reach out to me directly, and then, I'll try to respond to you in that moment. Otherwise, it takes a little more time. But I won't spend a lot of time, doing any big introduction. I know that you're here because you care about public education, you care about what's happening in your community, and I wanted to, at least be able to spend more time trying to answer some of the questions you may have. I'll give you some broad strokes about at least the transition and a little of what Errol Davis has left as essential work for us to carry on, and some of the things that the board has already given me direction on that they'd like to see us ramp up for as quickly for this current school year as possible. So the first piece is that Austin was incredibly gracious and understanding during the transition, recognizing that Atlanta had a few more challenges than Austin, and that it was important for us to do a smart transition for both of the school communities, but particularly for Atlanta, that needed a little more time for the outgoing superintendent and the incoming superintendent to be able to hit the ground running. So the board did approve early in the spring a transition statement, if you will, to allow me to have access to the district critical data sources, and even an opportunity to do some early reorganization and to put on the book for action key human resource position. So that was the start of the work. What we mostly got consumed in was learning a lot, spending a lot of time with Errol Davis in particular on issues, whether we agreed or disagreed about the approach. He was just trying to understand the lead up to those decisions or the ones that might be coming out of the box pretty hot on my first board meeting, and to give the board some time to spend with me as I thought about the future. So it's a new board, by and large. It was, there are a few people that were part of the transition, but we have a large number of new board members and the new superintendent. So we took immediate steps to have a retreat and talk about short and long-term goals and to kind of break the district apart into the cluster areas and allow each board member and each at-large member to talk about the things that they were concerned about that were really pressing in the district. So I'll start with the cluster piece first, because that's typically what people are interested in hearing about. But there were some patterns to the clusters, and I don't think it's a surprise for Atlanta that we had a real human resource concern as it related to making sure that we had principals in place for the start of the school year. But most importantly, I have to have principals in place so they can then staff their schools. Otherwise, the district would have a very similar day one start like previous years, short over 100 teachers, budgets not being completely planned for, or worse, for secondary schools, no master schedules, and therefore students would not have individual schedules for the start of the day, and so on and so forth. So that leadership at the school-based level was really important, and there wasn't a single area, including North Atlanta, that didn't have a few vacancies. But we did see some huge turnover at the high school level. 2/3 of the high school principals turned over. And so getting some stability, getting people in place, doing the best we can with the pool that did surface. I know everyone's not particularly happy or agree with everything, but we certainly made our best effort to try to bring more rigor to the principal selection process, and then also do things in the right way so they could get on board, have the summer to plan, and also finish staffing their schools. So cluster by cluster, we did those things, and where we found big trends, we worked during the transition to be able to address them. And some things, like, I know there are going to be some questions, I'm sure, about overcrowding and things of that sort. Errol Davis and I did work in real time to talk about the budget that was getting passed for the next school year and try to figure out ways to shake loose $2-3 million so we could get some immediate additional, don't want to use acronyms, FTEs or full-time equivalents, that's teachers, in place to relieve some of the overcrowding pressures that we had. So there were some things, it wasn't perfect, but at least we were able to talk about the things and come to agreement so that the board would know that the superintendent was at least involved in some of the key decision-making that we would all have to live with when we started the new school year. And probably the other piece about short and long-term goals after we worked through the clusters, there were a lot of things, like we had transportation issues, we had food nutrition issues, we had contract issues with some of our key vendors. There were some contracts and memorandums of understanding that were just kind of stuck in legal, and we were did not know where they were or how we were going to get those things in place. The board talked about safety and security, also our curricular focus and what were some areas that were already seeing that we had challenges in, and those are like short-term, immediate, and I would almost say, even before we started the school year, if you could figure them out, fix them, right? And then the big issue was really like, how do you open the school year with more just cohesiveness, less craziness, a little more, starting with some small efforts, although they seem small, they're huge for us to do, so that we could start building some trust back with the community about how we were going to run schools. And so getting to the opening of the school year, which I will talk about more if people are interested in hearing it, had a lot to do with bringing the leadership team together, having the central administration and people have to do the work on the front lines with principals to see the school site and to make those things better, with them reconciling together what they were saying and what schools needed so that everybody was on the same page about how we would have to start the school year. So those were a lot of the big things that were happening. So making sure desks were in place and principals were hired and teachers were hired should be the normal process for a school system, but it wasn't so normal for Atlanta. And those were the kinds of things that we were trying to do, big picture. We didn't get much done on long term, but certainly cluster by cluster, short term goals were things that we really made a seriously concerted effort to get right. Some of that paid off. We had probably the smoothest day one in the history of Atlanta in recent years. We had a big call center. I mean, they had hundreds of people ready staffed to answer all the problems. And we had to go check the phone lines to make sure the phones were working because we had so few calls. And I started getting panicked that we were doing something wrong again. That was good. Day 2, 3, 4, and 5, you know, give me a run for my money. But day 1, you know, was a good start. If we can kind of keep that energy and keep reminding people of our core purpose, which is children, I think that Atlanta will be able to kind of get itself back on track and we'll be able to accelerate our pace around achieving the goals and the hopes and dreams of Atlanta. So I'll stop there and make sure that you have as much time as you can possibly have to ask me questions. And if there's anything else about, you know, transition, entry in the last couple of weeks, I'm happy to answer those questions and details too. Of course, some of my board members, if you have questions for them specifically, you're welcome. They're happy to do that as well. But I will stop and entertain any questions from the audience.
Oh, have you already written down?
Wow.
We have another microphone. Let me kind of borrow this.
Yeah, please.
First of all, before I ask the question, I wanted to recognize we have City Councilman Andre Dickens is here. We also have he's newly elected. He was part of the new wave that came in the last election. And we have two candidates for House Seat 54, which is Ed Lindsay's old seat. There's Beth Deskin and Bob, is he still here? Oh, right in front of Bob Gibley. Republican and Democrat, and then there's also an independent, Bill Rosa. And if former County Commissioner Rob Fitz is, yeah, I'm not sure how I missed him, his seersucker suit, but he's in the back there.
So I can sit
down. First question is, recent comments by you and board members indicate support for expanded pre-K and early learning. Are there any plans to expand pre-K availability for the Northern Cluster and specifically for the Hispanic population?
Well, first I'll say that I think we want to offer early childhood opportunities for any family that wants to have them. So it's not an issue of Hispanic or our non-Hispanic students. It's really if you want the early learning opportunity, how do we figure out a pathway to do that? I am a firm supporter of early childhood education. I've even been in districts where we successfully were able to do 3- and 4-year-old programs. I think that St. Paul, Minnesota had an extraordinary design that was tied to the Minnesota Early Learning Program. It was called MELF. I encourage you to look into it if that's something that you're excited and want to focus on. But for Atlanta Public Schools, the approach of how we go about early learning will require, I did a couple of slides actually just this past week, looking at how we do that with our community, how we do that for 0 to 3 year old, up to T-O, 3 year old. And I know that we're very reliant on our partnership partnerships with other community organizations, especially for families in high poverty. So there are a couple of lessons we've learned, especially by working with outstanding foundations that have supported this for a long time, like the McKnight Foundation out of Minneapolis. But one piece is that there are ways to do this. I know that we have some folks that are running for the legislature, and you asked me what might the legislature do. I think this is something that the Georgia legislature could really do, make a commitment on how they want to go about doing statewide, across the board, every child with early childhood education. You can fund it, there's some things that are happening already around the lottery, around special, tax commitments and so on and so forth. But there's also a lot that we can do around educating our parents in how they might be able to, even if you can't afford it, really participate and help us make every dollar that we use an efficient dollar. What we found over, at least in my experience, is that you can offer a lot of seeds. And typically, families that are not educated on how to access those things, even though they are free, leave a lot of vacancies for seeds in early childhood education. And one way that we continue to do the communication piece and often, but another way that we were able to open seeds for families was to create a sliding scale for being able to pay for those services. And families of more means and those in poverty were able to pay for the seats and help us, bring more money into the district to then open more seats for families, whether they were in poverty or not. But I do think that Atlanta this is a growth area for us that we could do a lot more in. And I would encourage, I know the board is very interested in this, but I would encourage the district to make a commitment along with other people in the community about a citywide strategy so that every community, area of the community can benefit from it. And it's only, I think, when you do it in that way that you're able to really elevate the entire city's educational experience. And I will tell you from research, we know it hands down, that the achievement gap can be stopped or at least minimized, right, by starting with high quality early childhood education. And for every dollar invested in that, you'll get a 7 to 14% rate of return for those dollars. And the research of Art Rolnick out of the Federal Reserve, I think, is what the legislature used in Minnesota to be able to kind of convince everyone in the state that this might be one of the best investments the state could make for itself as a plan for its coming future.
This is a little bit of a follow-up, and you may have answered it. What is the single most valuable action that your legislature can do to support APS? And I would follow up with that is, how can parents help with your legislative agenda? Right? What way are you going to outreach, or how are you going to involve parents in doing that?
Right, and there's a lot more the legislature can do specifically for Atlanta public schools, right? So, but I mean, I think as the capital city and also the spirit with which most people are able to move things in the legislature, you've got to think about those issues that everyone can get behind and move the entire state or the community around. So my strategy about how I've always thought about, I've made a point to always try to work in capital cities. Whether it was, Washington, D.C. is the nation's capital, St. Paul, Austin, now Atlanta, that there's a benefit, and a double-edged sword about being in the backyard of that much political activity. But I think it's important that the leadership of the capital city district, part of what it needs to do is to have a legislative agenda that, yes, supports your school system, but also allows for other districts, especially smaller ones that have less leverage than the larger ones, to be able to be part of that agenda to move the state forward. And so I've always encouraged whether it's our legislative liaison or our elected officials, to think about those things first and how do we first do no harm to other people in the efforts that we're making so that all children can benefit for any leverage that your capital city can bring to bear. And so I've seen lots of things, everything around, you know, addressing areas of, you know, fair funding for parts of the agenda that would be important for every school district to be able to land on. I've seen, you know, improvements around setting the stage for college readiness and what do we want to do and talk to the legislature and the state board about as it relates to the acceptable standards for learning throughout the state. And so the gamut is huge. I've even seen areas where, you know, depending on what a community needs, but I think that Atlanta has a pretty solid approach using SLOS for our operational dollars or our facility dollars, our capital dollars. But there are other communities that don't have as much, and so there are parts of an agenda that can help us with facilities and things of that sort as well. So I would think about those things. And as far as parents being able to be part of that agenda, something that we have not announced yet, but that we are absolutely working on, is that the APS just simply has very few, if any, organized by the district with the understanding and blessing of the leadership of the district, advisory councils, and other, you know, core task force workers filled with not staff but community members that can help us shape and advise the district on where we really want these areas to go. So I am looking for, like, oversight committees. I'll be announcing, especially one regarding our facilities after the board has determined what it wants to do with its SLOS dollars. But we need some oversight with the community about how the things are implemented and the kind of timelines we've made commitments about. A district advisory committee. I know we really don't have anything organized around special education, and that has been a backbreaker for APS. And there are others. I've talked about budget and finance is a huge one, and that it needs to be, you know, with a clear charge from one year to the next about what we're asking our citizenry to help us with. And so I think those are, and another one, of course, your legislative agenda. You want a policy advisory committee where the community can weigh in on things that will be important to them based on what the legislature does. So you can expect to hear more about that in the upcoming months.
This question is both for you and the board members, so I think maybe we'll let the board members answer first, and you can tell them if they got it right or not. In North Atlanta, the retention rate drops off drastically after fifth grade, and I know Cynthia and Nancy know a lot of people go to private schools and move out of the district, so the question is that an issue to you? Is that going to be a priority going forward, and if so, how would you improve retention rates among kids that leave elementary school, leave public school, elementary school?
Actually, our retention rates are not quite as bad as I think the anecdotal evidence indicates. The last figures I saw were that we were really only losing about 20%. And we don't want to lose anybody. We want everybody to stay all the way through, and as many people in this audience know because they've been there with me and with Nancy, we've worked really hard to spread the gospel of our wonderful public schools and cluster for the last 20 years. As far as improving those retention rates, I think the way we do that is continue to serve the needs of the community in the same way that we do it in the Brady Cluster or the Jackson Cluster or the Bay Cluster or anywhere else we sit. We do have some capacity issues right now, and I think we're going to need to be figuring out how to deal with those in some ways, that we're victims of our own success on that point, because we have filled all these schools. And so I think we're going to have to be looking at that, but I think the way that we continue to have good retention rates and improve those is to serve the needs of every child in the class. And simple as that.
You
want
to take it? You want me to make some answer?
No.
Thank you. Okay, they get
one.
The
only thing I would add to that, the regular
check for
work. Sure. Only thing I would add to that is, like, we just be really, we want to be be careful. I think if we want to answer these kinds of detailed questions, I just want to be sure that we can understand, is it retention rates for the district or a particular area, or is it progression rates from one grade level to the next? But we just need to be sure that, and because I know, certainly when people say, the graduation rate, do you want the federal one, or do you want your state formula? We have to just be sure that we're answering the right question. So, kind of on average, I think for this area, the number that's kind of more spot on for 20% is Sutton Middle School. Right? But when you look at the entire cluster, you might see some that are lower, you might see some that are going to, there are some that are actually higher, in the 90s. So I just want to be thoughtful about that. And what I'd like to do, if we want to do this, I'm happy to do it, we can get a very specific response around retention versus progression and break it down by grade level or at least by school if people want to see those numbers. But it is a mix. Not everything's going to be nailed right there on that average.
And I will say, over the years, one of the things that we've heard over and over again, and I think that was addressed this year, is we have teachers in just about, I know there's a couple, every classroom. We have principals in every school. Everybody has schedules, as Maria said. So there are so many things that I think drove people away in the past that were really addressed and addressed quickly. And I think through this year, you're going to see that even more and more. I think the confidence level and the trust of this community, there's not going to be any difference transitioning from 5th grade to 6th grade to 9th grade, because it's going to be really cohesive and very seamless. And that's something we're striving for. And I think we've worked hard on in the past, but we're going to get it better.
The next question has to do with charter schools. Apparently, you met with charter school leaders recently. And
yeah, you're all in my business.
You got a blog. I know where you are.
Yesterday.
I know where you are.
I'm just putting a little camera on myself and let everybody.
But the question is, how do you feel apparently incorporating or working with charter schools to improve the system, and in particular, Atlanta Classical Academy just opened up in North Atlanta, which is our first charter school in this area. So how do you intend to work with them? Are you going to incorporate what they're doing or try to incorporate it? What's your theory or philosophy on that?
Yeah, the charter school conversation for me isn't about charters at all. I don't wake up every day and think about the charter movement or what is reform as it relates to charter. And board members, everybody has their own opinion about this, so I am not speaking for the board on this one. So, it may respectfully disagree. But for me, the conversation is about parent choice, and that you as a parent, right, the caregiver of the child, knows better than anyone, more than me, this board, or any teacher, what you really believe your child needs for the right learning environment. And as the superintendent of any district, not just Atlanta, not just because of the relationship or the structure of charters here, I believe that we still live in a democracy and that you, in your choice for your child, need to do what's right for your child. Some people will say, I'm fine with Atlanta Public Schools. I can send my kid to Sutton. I'm good. Others will say, I'm good up to this grade level. Others will say, I'm just not down with this at all. I'm just going to homeschool. Others will say, I have a faith-based background. I went to Catholic schools, and my kids are going to go to Catholic schools, and that's a legacy for our family. I think it's all great. I want our country to have a great education system for everyone so that people can pick and choose what they need for their child when they need it. Now, what I want to do in my job, though, as a graduate of public school, as someone who did attend a public land-grant institution like Auburn, and also private schools like Tulane and Harvard, I can tell you that I still feel like, no matter how the design got built for me, I made those choices along the way, and I was able to kind of map my education, after my parents told me to go to public school first, but map my education the way I wanted to, and it was great. So what I want to be able to do, though, as a superintendent, as someone who does support public schools, which does include charter schools, let's be clear, they're not private schools, and they're not, privatized, you know, public light or anything. They're real public schools. That these entities, our community schools that have been in APS, you know, forever, as we've known it growing up, all of us are old enough to remember what it was like before charter schools, and also our public schools that are part of APS, these children, all these children are our children. I'm not going to pick and choose between them, and I'm not going to treat anyone like a stepchild who, you know, we would want to go lock in a closet or something. That is, it's not going to be a Harry Potter moment. This is that we're really going to, that was under the staircase. But I fully believe that there's a way for us to work together so that the public school options, our portfolio of options for public schools, can all be high quality options. And that from the public school space, parents can pick and choose what they need at the right time. And that's what I want to make strong. That's what I believe in. That's what I want to try to see happen. I know that this is a board that over time has sponsored and supported various charter schools with lots of different designs. And they closed some too. So the spirit with which we'll go about it is, you know, can we find the best, if there's interest, and people do apply, we can't tell them not to apply. We want high quality applicants, because I certainly don't want to build schools that aren't any better than what we've been able to deliver in some of our circumstances that are not as high performing as we want them. So you are right, you have one in your neighborhood. There are criteria by which these schools have to, you know, live up to. They have to really be public. You can't have anything that you would not be doing in an Atlanta public school happening in any of the charter schools. So we have to be really thoughtful about that, very diligent about that. And when we hear or see things that are either disconcerting about academics or disconcerting about the culture that's being created in a school or something that would not meet the sniff test in a regular public school as we all knew them growing up, then those are things that the board has to address over time. But I don't think that, at least for where APS is, we really, in a very patchwork way, created a lot of different things, I know with good intent, but we're at a point where, because we haven't managed it with an academic strategic direction, it's a mix of stuff that's not so great and kind of average and kind of good and a lot of not perfectly targeted in a direction. So what we're ending up seeing now in our budget situation is that you can have charter schools, which by the way has literally doubled almost in the last 4 years. In the last 4 years, I think it went from like 4,400 students to almost 8,000 students, I think it's 7,600 now. But it has been a big growth, you know, supported by the board, sponsored by the board, chartered by the board in this area. And right off the top, just to make it clear, we don't get to take a dollar until we allocate dollars to our charter schools first. And what I'm seeing in our budget, and I'm not judging the past, what I'm seeing in the budget is that we can hardly afford what we created. There's a lot of tension in the money around choice, which was one strategy. And then another strategy was preserve and protect neighborhood schools that are, you know, APS community schools. And when you try to pull those two worlds together without merging a larger strategic direction academically and educationally for what you want in the community, I can tell you already that, you know, we know that we have budget challenges. I inherited them. But at the same time, if we continue down this path, it will only get more challenging for both designs of schools. And so that's something that I could not figure out before day one. But I know that I'll be presenting and working with the board on the budget, and these, along with many other unconnected strategies, have to be addressed, and we're going to have to prioritize what we really want to do based on what the community believes is the right future for the district. And I won't elaborate on it now, but the biggest question that's on the table as we ramp up for November is which operating model, as we are required to do by the state, which operating model for flexibility are we going to pick for Atlanta Public Schools? And there are lots of different designs. Some will be, you know, there's one extreme, and then there's the other, and then there's some things in between. And without going into all those details right now, I will say that operating model should not be decided based on what the model says in the law. The model should be decided based on the vision and the mission and the values of the Atlanta community. And then from there, you should pick a model and not get hung up in what each one of them say. You want to say, this is what we're trying to be. Which one will help us get there the fastest and at the highest quality levels?
These two are kind of related. They have to do with selecting children on extreme or on the outside of the mainstream, but I'm going to read them both.
Okay.
In Austin, I believe there was a program in place for students to be screened for dyslexia, since 1 in 5 children have dyslexia. Do you think that program should be implemented here? And then the other one is, have you had the opportunity to review the gifted and talented program at ACS? What are your thoughts on equal access to the program? I guess it's kind of identifying students with dyslexia or other special needs and then gifted children also.
Right. I mean, I do believe we should screen at the appropriate grade level and get students support for dyslexia as soon as possible. So much so that I had one board member who did have a special needs child, and you know, I think, you know, just by being as close to a person like that with a child with those needs, that you see very quickly how hard it is on a family to find their need for their child, whether it's this or gifted and talented or audio. You can feel how hard it is to do a great job as a parent when you can't, you know your kid needs the support and you can't find the right support in a school or a program or in the district. And so we had started working with and having conversations with the University of Texas in Austin about actually doing a center, like making sure that we had a complete school dedicated to this particular need. It was one where, you're right, more and more students, I mean, if you're doing a great job, you can see the challenges that they're having, and if you're able to do services quickly, services at a high quality, students can quickly reintegrate into a classroom for even, you know, like into gifted and talented. It's not something that, I know it's something that a student is likely to deal with for the rest of their life, but there are tools and strategies to help them early on so they can better navigate. I know it's like a very busy life. And that, yes, because the district can't figure out how to get this email to work on my other one. You have no idea how much work I have to do. My desktop isn't working either. So I do everything on one side, and when I can't get on that one, when it burns out, I have to move to another. So I mean, I'm a full service superintendent, so that's why I will get to it if, no matter how many barriers people put in front of me. A believer and supporter in that, and I don't want the students' need in this area to become, you know, their life as a learner. I mean, you can learn skills to navigate that well, and then be able to move on in other areas of your life for learning. And so I don't know if people agree or disagree with that, but I certainly feel like I've seen enough to believe that we could. That I was hopeful in Austin that we could really elevate it to a higher level and really serve our region, not just our school district, with a dedicated center. And for GT, yes, I have started to review that. If you haven't read that 1,400-page equity study, read the executive summary. And then pick an area that you want to look at and go to that page, because it's a very long read. But the good news and bad news is that there's some really sad parts of what's happened over time in APS. But the good news, the silver lining on it, is that at least, you know, it's been it's out. Like, we know now. Like, I think people intuitively knew. I think people had lots of anecdotal stories and qualitative experiences about it. But now we have some quantifiable evidence of what it really looks like. So one of the areas before the equity audit results when I was in transition, but even after, was about GT. And, you know, so the equal access part, as you will know if you read the study, that is not happening across the district. That there are far more students in North Atlanta that have access to gifted and talented students in other areas. And that's something that we have to absolutely fix and provide opportunities for students across Atlanta. But gifted and talented to me is not just like on the traditional, you know, core content areas. You know, we have students that are gifted in, I'm not trying to make certain say, but I will say they have some gifts that they are born with, or whether it's your voice or your ability to just be a great musician or athletic ability that that people look at you and you're like, oh my gosh, you're 3 years old and you can really golf. So those are some of the other gifted things I see in students that don't get tested on that gifted and talented assessment. And there's got to be a way that we are able to find those other gifts in students and allow those things to be nurtured early on in school. And I know this is a long answer to the question, but I'm going to have to digress for a moment. I went to school in Spain and did a year abroad when I was at Tulane and studied in Seville, Spain. And I do love the country and I love the culture, and so but I don't get to go very often, of course. So on my 20th anniversary, yes, I am that old, and don't say anything that. On my 20th anniversary of my junior year abroad, I went back, not because of that, but more because I heard about a Picasso exhibit that was being shown in Barcelona. And I'm going to try to make the story shorter, but in Barcelona, I went to see it because it was Pablo Picasso, the early years, and it was all this big, kind of international coverage about how this exhibit was so extraordinary and it had, like, the most unique collection of the early years for Picasso. So I'm going to ask you, how old do you think Picasso was in the early years? Give me a guess. What do you think?
Five.
What? 50?
11.
11?
Five.
Five. Yeah, like it was closer, like, I think he was 7 years old. Like, they started at, like, 7. He was already, like, a master painter. Like, the painting he did of his mother, I think, on the back of a bread box or something, like, brought you, like, you're, like, crying, like, what child can see their mom like this? I mean, you felt his love for her in this painting. And I couldn't help but wonder, in public education, how many Pablo Picassos we have erased because of the way we're doing our business around gifted and talented. And, you know, so it's that, it's like that exhibit haunts me. And then it got really freaky when you were a teenager. Master, like he was like better than his dad. I think his dad even said, you're so much better than me, you gotta go away because you're taking business from him. But I can't remember, but it was a very interesting observation. And I would hope that over time for Atlanta, and it's something I really believe in, whether it's fine arts or athletics, that all of this is co-curricular, not extracurricular, not something that should be separated, but that when it comes to gifted and talented, we need to listen for and be able to identify the strengths of a child, those gifts, right, before we squash them. And then find pathways to nurture that so that they can continue to have a more in-depth experience in their public school. And so that would be my hope around that. I know we're nowhere near it because we're talking about equal access to just the regular gifted and talented. But I think that, if we were able to change that paradigm to identify the strengths of a child early on and nurture those things, we will have done something great for our world.
Thank you.
The question is, how
how have you brought more rigor to the selection of principals? And I want to add, because I heard you say this at the board meeting, talk about your views on hiring teachers. And do we need to fill vacancies, or, you know, for the sake of filling vacancies, what's your philosophy on that?
So the first thing about principals, I mean, it was just one thing. Again, I'm not trying to judge anything that was going on in the past. I'm just being honest. Like, it was clear that there was no one at the highest administrative seat in the district interviewing every, I don't even say finalist, not even every finalist as a principal for a school. So somewhere along the way, somewhere in the bowels of ABS administration, someone was making a decision about who would be leading schools, there was no connection between the vision and the direction, the big vision and direction, where the superintendent sitting at the table with the board member's direction in mind saying, do you believe this about learning? Do you want to be part of this direction? What skills do you have to support if we decide for English language learning we're going to do two-way dual language immersion across the district? And you're applying for a school that has a large, you know, a great mix of English speakers and non-English speakers. Can you do that job? What are the skills you have? No one was sitting in every finalist interview. And then, so you know, if it wasn't every finalist, it absolutely wasn't the city finalist. So the big change that you know, I've made, I've done this throughout my career, and I certainly did in Austin, and I know I built probably arguably the best leadership team in the country, I think, in Austin over the 5 years, because we really made a commitment to human resources. We really made a commitment to people. We're a business of people. Love it or leave it, that's where we spend our money. Overwhelmingly, salaries, benefits, professional development on adults. That's where the money goes. And so you're not taking the time to make sure that you're looking in the eyeball. You have pretty eyes. I've never looked at them before. No, they're really nice. You're not looking in the eyes of the principal and really asking those questions and being comfortable with who you're hiring. I think we've done a great disservice to our families and children. And I think that we have nothing to change. That the associate superintendents, the people who are going to be evaluating these folks, not only understand what we're doing, but when we do a principal profile, I had to go back and check their work, and some people didn't do it, but I'm going and pulling out my old papers from months ago, I didn't throw them away, I'm pulling out those principal profiles again, and saying, when you do a principal profile with a community, and they're saying, this is what went well in my school, this is not what went well in our school, and here's our hopes for the future, when you start as a principal in our school, your entry plan into that school needs to take all those things into consideration. We didn't ask our community to work on all that stuff for us only to interview you about it and not hold you accountable on the back end for doing that work. So we pulled in the principal profile piece. We also, and it wasn't perfect because I had one slip by it. But that's because no one told me, but like that thing that we do in APS where people don't do the background checks correctly and you don't know what that stuff, that's over. I've got to talk to you about the new head of human resources too. But we've got to get out of that loose letting not only people like get in past the application part, but like they're in the school and they actually got on the board agenda for action and we hired them. That aside, the basic stuff we should be doing well in human resources, the bigger vision is making sure that we're hiring people that will do, make sure that we're addressing the challenges, make sure that we're keeping the things that communities value the most and help them achieve their vision for the future. But interviewing them, being at the table, and looking at the semifinals, the top three or five for a position, and interviewing every last one of them, giving them like the real interview, so you can see your talent. You want to see who's coming up, who might surface again. They may be interviewing for this job, but once you're at the seat with the superintendent, to me, if you're doing it right, any of those people should be able to be the principal of the school. So you're not looking at, can they be a principal, which is what I felt like I was doing earlier in the spring. Like, is this person even qualified? I mean, I had those kind of questions in my mind, or did God, did they do a background check? I mean, those were the things I was thinking about going into them. I want to be in a place where when we look at the top, we're so excited about them, we're thinking, hey, you may not be the best match here, but ooh, we want to make sure that you have a chance to meet this community over here because they are going to love you, right? And you have the skills you need to move the school along. So that's how we want to do leadership at every level. And principals are the heart that, you know, or the, you know, like the lead for the school. They set the tone, they set the culture. They do then go pick those teachers. So when you ask about, it's not just about filling teacher vacancies. As a matter of fact, it's not perfect. I'm still short about 10. And I was short 10 when we started the school year because it got really thin on the back end, and I just couldn't do it. There were long-term substitutes that I felt like could have a better job of teaching our kids than some of the people in the last round of the teaching pool, because Atlanta's just behind. But, you know, I'm going to fill them, but I'm going to fill them with the right people. We want great people in front of our children. But what we're going to start doing also to change the way that we're doing it is we have to start recruiting early. APS is recruiting teachers. Like, some of them, they didn't start recruiting until like the summer. I mean, like, I'm like a couple of weeks, you know, a month before school. Like, this will never do. We have to be recruiting our teachers all on the way, telling them where we think they could be, helping them figure out how they can get from Harvard or Auburn to us, and also, you know, making sure that our principals have enough time to look at their talent and pick the right people for their team. But those are just a few things that we have to do, but I know it can be done. We're doing it all the time in Austin, and what I did do to kind of just reset all that stuff in HR that has plagued APS forever, I brought my four great, great leaders in Austin over human resources. I left two, I recruited two. And so two of them are with me right now. And yes, Austin's not speaking to me much anymore. But I brought two with me, and the one who is actually leading human resources, retired from Austin, but I asked her to retire but come immediately with me to Atlanta. And so you have a seasoned, very capable, no-nonsense, understands how it's supposed to be, and will help us all clean up HR so that you are happy and comfortable with the people we're putting in our schools, in our buses, cleaning our buildings, the whole gamut. She knows it from top to bottom. And we have the second line of defense, learning and growing with us too.
And replacing vacancies with great teachers is one goal, but we have some teachers, and you don't have to agree with this, but they're not all great at APS. So do you have a strategy for replacing some of the less than stellar teachers? And then a second part of that question is, apparently the equity audit shows that there's a disparity in teacher quality within APS, and apparently there was a similar finding in Austin, and they're wondering how you dealt with it in Austin, but I think more applicable is how you plan on dealing with it in Atlanta.
I was there for 5 years. I don't remember us doing an equity audit, and I'm not sure what piece of research people are using from the Austin piece. But we did have a disparity in teacher quality in Austin from a geographic perspective, right? So for us, I think people here talk a lot about North and South. In Austin, it was East and West, you know, the interstate and river in different ways. But I think every community faces what everyone's been talking about as it relates to equity. And so what we did in Austin was, I mean, it was the largest federal grant for teacher effectiveness and quality I'd given in the country. It was $62.3 million of investment around what we called REACH. And it had many different goals, but one was to try to get, by putting those resources for salaries, support, and professional development on the east side, which was where the inequities really were, we would be able to attract, retain, and bring from other places and across the interstate to East Austin higher quality teachers, and that they would stay. Now, this is, you know, grant for grant, and I think the federal government has, you know, its own philosophy about what they think are the right things to do to get reform in education. So I'm not sure everybody would agree with what's happened at the U.S. Department of Education. I know as superintendents, we all haven't agreed either. But the good news and bad news about how that works is that, you know, it had a piece in it around strategic compensation. And that was, you know, of course, you get a bonus if you did better, if your school did better, if your class did better, and so on and so forth. And I think Atlanta, of all places, know more about strategic comp and how that can go well and not so well in a district. So ours went pretty well because not perfect, but it went better than I think most places because. And I want to thank our teacher association, the labor group that work with teachers, because they too agreed with the research as I did, that I think that we are an organization, or we're the kind of people in education where you've got to get motivation right, and not everyone, and hardly the majority, will be motivated by just the money. I just think we've proven that enough in education that I think we need to kind of let that go a little bit. And so we changed our design to do a bit more. So yes, you would be compensated around performance, but you would also be compensated for doing what we call like learning objectives. So you would set learning goals for yourself, and you would get a really great mentor, teacher, and you would be able to do things that I think most people would typically never consider, especially, you know, depending if you're like a hardcore private sector, you know, the bottom line is the bottom line. But if you get out of that in education, you get a little bit more towards support and everything, you absolutely, and research shows this, you get more out of people. Those kinds of incentives don't speak as much, I think, to the teaching ranks. As it does in other, you know, sectors of work. So we mixed ours up more, and it was not just about the, you know, how you performed on the state assessment, although that was a significant part of it. But we had other pieces that teachers reported hands down over and over again. At the end of the day, these are the parts we liked the most, and while, you know, I'm pleased that I earned an extra $4,000, what they really wanted to keep were the pieces that supported them as a professional and got them what they needed to be more successful in the job, and that we actually recognized that, and that was part of their strategic compensation. So that was how we tried to deal with some of the disparity issues on teacher quality. But again, we still attracted a lot of 3 years or less, you know, teachers into the area. The school environments are tough. I mean, you know, you've heard about Atlanta. Atlanta is not the only urban city in America that has a troubled high-need school. And so we had a lot, too. And those were really tough to recruit for. And they had a lot of turnover, and the attrition rates were pretty high. But I think that that replacing the non-stellar teachers, to your other point, is sort of twofold. One, I know we're a business of instruction, right? We're supposed to be teaching people and supporting young people and things of that sort. But once they get, and even we struggle with that, but we are not as good as supporting and professionally developing our adults, including our teachers. So if you have a great principal who understands that is really at the core of your job, yes, you need to balance the budget. Yes, you need to make sure that your PTA meetings are scheduled and you're managing the school. But really, you have two other jobs that are super important. One is making sure that you're supporting and you know what you're looking for every time you walk into a classroom. So if that teacher's teaching algebra, you better know what you're looking for to know if they're a good algebra teacher. If you're not able to do that, need to assign that teacher to your assistant principal, who may also have been out of background in math and has been better trained than you on how to evaluate that teacher. So, I mean, you have to be very smart even about how you delegate some of the teacher evaluation, and you've got to get trained for your AP, which is why I'm going to go back to make sure you know what your talent pool looks like beyond the finalist. You want to see everybody else who's coming up, so you can be thinking about your talent map and who is closer to ready than others, and who you might be able to say, okay, this AP is likely not to be a principal this year, but I'm going to encourage the principal of South Atlanta to consider this person for a position, because they really do understand STEM. They really do understand fine arts or something that a school may need, because the assistant principals are part of that team and they do evaluate teachers as well. So you can't forget that part. And so the replacing to me is first, can you need to support them? And because the first 3 years, they will struggle. It's just, and they have to start somewhere, and they will also start at Atlanta Public Schools. So get them the support in the 3 years, get them support beyond that. But the non-stellar part for, you know, I think there's different levels. Non-stellar, like they just really don't want to be in the job and they hate children and they hate middle school. I've seen those teachers. Just get them out. The other side, though, is that if you really still want to be in education, what they're asking for is support and help, because they do want to be a stellar teacher. And so I don't know if I agree with just replacing them, but I do think you can, if they've got the right heart, you can really help them get the right mind and skills. And that is something the principal, the APs, have to know how to do. And that's part of our work from a central administration level.
That answers my next question, too, about teacher effectiveness.
What time is it?
Up here. I was going to give the next question to Matt Moreland. He's the director, or I'm sorry, he's the chairman of the budget committee, and I think he'll appreciate this question. Do you read the financial deconstruction blog? I know he does.
Who?
That's the only way I know to make sense of the APS budget. What do you have planned to make it more understandable to everyday Joe Sixpack? And second is, do you believe that there should be some connection between spending and specific educational outcomes?
The answer to the first question is yes. I'm an avid reader of and talker with Bob Stockwell, who is here in his obsession with APS, but we are lucky to have him and all that he digs through and the insight that he provides. This past spring, I had the opportunity to serve as chair of our budget commission, which is a role I will have next year as well. The first time we went through this process, the key pieces that we were talking about were transparency. There were a lot of people who felt like they had absolutely no idea where our $658 million were going and where they could find out where it was supposed to go online. Second was whether we were tying that money to outcomes as much as we should have, right? We have a tendency in APS, like a lot of systems, of throwing hundreds of millions of dollars in a direction and not really checking to see if what we have spent our money on is actually working in the interest of our kids. And the third was the timeline, right? The FY13 budget was passed on June 28th, 2 days before it was legally required. And that is what led to the 84 vacancies that we had on the first day of school. That August was it. We had a budget passed so late that didn't allow people to hire. And so what we committed to as a board was three things last January. One, we were going to pass a budget that gave teachers a raise for the first time in 5 years. Two, we were going to pass a budget that didn't have furlough days for our employees for the first time in 4 years. And third is we were going to pass a budget in April. Because when you pass a budget in April, 2 months, 3 months earlier than we had the year before, that allows offices in the central office, it allows our principals to begin planning for the next school year. This was not a perfect budget. We are not spending our money as efficiently and as effectively as the four of us and the 74 of you think that we should. But that is a responsibility that we take very seriously. And we will meet as a board on Monday with Maria to start the conversation about what the next budget will look like. We're meeting for a day-long retreat to discuss our mission, vision, and core values. And embedded in that conversation is, in September, we're going to have a public conversation about what we want our budget parameters to be for the next year. In October, we're going to vote on those. And then we will meet, just like we did last year, downtown, in communities, coming to LSC meetings and PTA meetings, community meetings, to be as informative as possible to you, to show you where we are both spending your tax dollars, but also attempting to provide your kids with as quality education as possible. I think we've made progress this year. I think every single one of us has done a lot of work too. Can I elaborate on one thing that Marie mentioned earlier?
I'm sorry, your time's up.
At the May board meeting, we had a briefing from the Georgia Department of Education about the operational model conversation that we're having. And at Maria's first board meeting in July, we appointed a task force that is meeting as we speak. It is composed and will meet every Thursday for the next 6 weeks. It is composed of principals from around the system, and each board member selected a member from their district who will serve on it. The RFP people selected one as well. In addition to folks from the central office administration, from finance and policy and legal and this, that, and the other thing, that will look at each of the five options that we have. They will meet weekly. Each one of us will host a community meeting over the next 3 or 4 weeks in our districts, the times and dates and locations for which you can find on our website. I would encourage you to read up on the website we have that will go live in the near future with a whole bunch of information, more than you would ever want to know about these five options, and then to come out and to ask questions and critique and share ideas as to what you think is the best model for the system.
Can I add anything?
Perfect.
The next question is about testing. One is your thoughts on high-stakes testing, how that fits into your philosophy of education. And the other one specifically deals with high school math and says that APS has horrible pass rates on the EOCTs in high school math. What do you plan to do to improve our math programs? I don't know. I assume that's a North Atlanta question. I don't know specifically what you're talking or he was talking about.
I can tell you. The pass rate for North Atlanta High School for the ninth grade EOCT was 25%. The pass rate for 10th grade geometry EOCT was 45%. That means 55% did not pass in 10th grade. So my question is specifically, now that the state is raising the bar on the newer test, Georgia Milestone test, and they're saying they're going to be harder, more rigorous, what is APS going to do to help these kids pass these tests and learn the math? Is there a specific plan in place?
So,
and that was North Atlanta, so that was the highest. And if you look at the rest of the grade groups up there too, if you look at the rest of APS, the scores were, it was like a 25%.
Yeah, so there, that's the math piece to our performance.
And that was the lowest
of all. As you make it clear. You know, I've had this question before, and so I absolutely, you know, went back with all of my attention to this issue, and as I continue to unearth our math situation, you know, there is no answer that it will ever be acceptable on what people have explained, not only on why we are where we are, but more, you know, challenging, like what our math experts believe we should be doing to move forward from where we are. So there are a couple of things. One was a body of explanation that was tied to reading about, you know, our ability to do rigorous reading around just, and this isn't of course North Atlanta necessarily, but around other schools, just even being able to read math problems and understand and unpack them. I actually spent I blogged about some of it, that I spent my first week making sure that I went to math classes so I could even see what it looked like on the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth day. So I know what you all have told me. I know, I mean, I can regurgitate the some of the plans that folks have talked about, but I can tell you this with my own experience and my own eyes, that we have an instructional framework that is tied to what the state expects so that students, in the end of their learning, can pass this particular test. I know what I saw on the first, second, third, fourth day, that we are already behind. Right? We spent a lot of time, I can tell we're already spending too much time on, I know we have to go back and refresh, but really, it feels not like a refresher, it feels very remedial. And so the expectation and the standard around, and I don't know how to put my finger on it, except I'm going to do my best guess today. We haven't defined what rigor absolutely has to look like to be able to achieve these expectations in the end. And we're never going to get there if people are saying things like, you know, we need to provide teachers, I can't remember, because none of it made sense to me. Provide teachers a new vision for mathematics. Right? And so, I mean, it's just very, I'm just being honest, like, it's just, that is so esoteric for math. Math, you're supposed to be able to do some of it. So, I mean, I was like, okay, I need a little bit more about what our strategy is.
They
just
saying,
like,
that coding
system. Yeah, it's like the math. We have a centralized, you know, curriculum instruction area, breakdown by content area. But as I, you know, because I came back, and y'all were there when I got the first time I heard this question. And so, I can tell you everything that they said to me, but I know none of it would be workable or acceptable. And what's clear to me is that, which is what I've said, and I'm, you know, going back, looking at everything from our grant to other resources on how we're going to come in and do stopgap work around what's already started to be another lackluster year, probably in math, if we don't have a better plan to put forward. So, the supports and things, they're all typical, but I can tell you, even on something as basic as we have an instructional platform for teachers to have access to. Within that platform, there are the expected, units and how far you're supposed to be in a scope and sequence to get to where you are. But as you work through every day in the district, and even if you pulled up the most basic part of that design, and I said it at the board meeting, and that was one of, we had like lows and grows, it's the area we really have to grow in. It wasn't just math, but it was really a lot of math, where teachers just still, I think, didn't know or can't put their finger on what the rigor is supposed to look like, where are we really supposed to be starting, what is remediation, what is on grade level, what is above grade level. And unless we break that down and absolutely are crystal clear about what you have to do, you will not be successful in an exam like this. And and there has to be some agreement with the district right now. I mean, we know where we are. That while you may not like the idea that you have more structured lesson plans, while you may not like the idea that we have more people who are going to be doing a direct instructional coaching with you, because teachers like to have a lot of autonomy in their classrooms, but on this one, we need a little more structure until we get the baseline part of it right, and then you can get to be a little more flexible. But this is a district-wide problem. I don't think there's a single school in the district that was a high flyer in this area that we could turn to and say, here's the model, what are you doing? And that's why I know it's deep and systemic, and we haven't done enough on getting those core questions nailed down, and then explicitly not, again, saying that we will provide a new vision for mathematics. It's like we have to really show people the step-by-step if we're going to get any traction around this area. So it is one of the most disconcerting areas around, content areas around work that we have to do in the district. And I know that's not an answer you want. It wasn't the one I wanted to get the first time. And I really need some time to figure that out. People have no clear pathway to how we're going to do that right.
This is part of the high school curriculum or part of the pathway, including the path of workbook.
Yeah, so part share with the board too. I mean, we've been going back and forth in Georgia around Common Core, right? APS's response to some of those things has been, well, like, we can't afford to just go do any textbooks or any supplemental materials and any of the things that you just described. That would be support to students and staff, because you don't want to buy it and then it's not aligned and it's not the right thing. So we haven't adopted textbooks either. We haven't adopted we haven't set the principles for the whole organization. This is the pathway we're going on, and we're going to invest these resources so that you have the support that you need and the matching professional development and the scope and sequence and the instructional framework that's exactly at the level that it needs to be. And here are the lesson plans we do expect you to teach at these key moments, because if you don't, they will fail. They will miss the key element that has to be like the power standard in what they need to learn at that moment in time to be successful at the end of the year. And so I've shared that with the board. I mean, this is part of the textbook, you know, everybody doesn't have a textbook at the beginning of the school year conversation, that APS has just, we have to stop, make a decision, make the investment, plan for it if necessary as part of our budget parameters, and really get ready for the next school year. Because right now, when we were leading up to it, when we were band-aiding, bubble-gumming everything around the support for teachers, because they don't have them. They really don't. That's about all I have for math, sadly, but I'm going to keep working on it, and one day soon you'll have a better answer. And then the other piece I think you asked about was...
your view on high-stakes testing.
Yeah, high-stakes testing. So I think high-stakes testing, I came out of a state where No Child Left Behind was born, where high-stakes testing, the commissioner had so much authority that he closed not only schools, but he closed two in Austin, before my watch, but two in Austin, and then whole districts around performance and board performance and superintendent performance. He unseated, they could unseat board members, and they did. They could fire superintendents, and they did. And they could close schools, and they did. And so the pressure, and I know what high-stakes testing feels like, and Georgia feels like a breath of fresh air by comparison. I mean, it was just that intense. So the culture around high-stakes testing, I can tell you, is just a demoralizing, sucks the wind out of teachers' sails like nothing I've ever seen. Even a bad principal doesn't shake them down. Like, high-stakes testing, to the extent that you feel like you just are constantly test prepping or worksheeting and you don't have any opportunity to be creative, I think it's unbelievably punitive. And as a result, and often, when they hired me those five years ago, there were several what they call multi-year academically unacceptable schools that were all going to be on the short list for closure. Some already were being closed. And it was just chaos. It was just chaos. Everybody was tense. The approach became not how do we achieve great things for children, and it became how do we just make sure we get over that hump. If you miss something by even 2 percentage points, right, they closed a middle school. Like, it was that intense. You were like, and Texas is tough, right? You could never get away with the performance in APS. Half the schools would be closed here. The percentage for passing, although, I would say you still want it to be higher, but they were like 72% or 77%. If you missed it by 75%, you had to answer to the state. So it was just a very intense environment. Having said that, we still were able to find ways to absolutely improve. And our way out of the high-stakes testing depression was that we just couldn't chase it anymore. Our goal could not be how do we get to the floor and crawl across it. It had to be, what really are we trying to do here? If we develop the whole child, if we care about their full development, if we want to see them be as good in fine arts and athletics as we want to see them do well in math and science, then all those things will come together and you will actually be a higher performer in general. How do we, look for ways to embrace and support social and emotional learning where you aren't a distraction in class. Discipline does need to be reduced, but, I mean, how do you teach a child skills to be able to say, you know, while the teacher's teaching, you and I need to go over in a peace corner and have a conversation about giving my pencil back. Not stab you in the hand with a pencil and, like, have a fist fight in the middle of the floor and disrupt the whole class for the next 20 minutes, right? These are things that were happening. These are things that happen at APS, but we want to be sure that we do something different that supports the child, that gives them an opportunity to, like, grow and be thoughtful and reflective about not only their behavior, but their learning. And so we let go. We made a pitch citywide to give us, the commissioner, of course, was not, I mean, he was like, do your accountability. But the rest of us said, we would like to have a board, the board set as a top priority, whole child, every child. We want the test to be an afterthought as much as possible, and let us do a better job of educating every child in every way that they need to be. Getting some of that permission and then turning around and getting big investments and supports from local people in our community about growing social emotional learning, expanding early childhood education, allowing us to create alternative pathways for graduation. Those are things that we were able to do, and it made a difference. It wasn't perfect, but everything from our grad rates started to shoot up, our dropout rates reduced. We were able to reduce by, I think it was almost 2/3, but now my brain's getting fuzzy on awesome days of all things about Atlanta. But I mean, we were able to do like 2/3 reduction in what we call our alternative school or suspensions and expulsions where kids went. I mean, we were able to do huge reductions, reduce over-identification of special education African-American kids into these programs. I mean, you could feel the tone change. And while, you know, there were still people who were stressed out about the test because you were on pins and needles and, you know, and the whole culture of Texas, even though the board was like, yes, we support you, but how did you do? Did we get better? What was our improvement rate? I mean, so there were people at the end of the day still went back to the test. But I think as an environment, we were able to kind of set our own expectation for ourselves, and that gave us some relief around the testing piece. And I think it saved us. I think the country across the board has gone a little too far on the high stakes testing conversation, and we need to pull back and get more balance. And I'm not saying pull all the way back, because I still think we need, if it weren't for No Child Behind, we probably would have never seen disaggregated data about black, brown, and poor children, special education children, English language learners. So there are some good things that come out of this. And yet, at the same time, you can't, you know, swing the pendulum all the way to the other side.
The question is about graduation rates, which obviously we want to increase those. But there's been studies that show 40% of Georgia high school senior or graduates take remedial classes. And I don't know what the number is for ABS. But I wonder if you think that's a valid metric for you to track. You know, it's one thing to graduate students, but don't you want them to be able to take college-level courses once they graduate, assuming that's the track they want to take?
Yes.
Do you know if they track that more?
It's a clearinghouse kind of approach to how data gets collected. I mean, districts, including APS, we look at that data, what happens to our students after, but again, it's tied to which universities students have applied for, you know, is there a match to the student, and so on and so forth. So it's not a perfect science, but it does give us a good indicator of whether or not our students actually go to college. And then once you're in college, the connection to those students, at least from what I've seen in APS, dissolves very quickly. I think our focus, by and large, has been on what's happening today. Can we get kids graduated in real time through the 12th grade? Far less focused on college readiness, college attendance, college retention. Those things, I think, certainly have not been a priority, probably a lot more so because of the things that that board member Meister mentioned about, you know, those areas where APS has struggled a lot, even failed, that causes me to lose a lot of trust in the system. over time. So we've been, I think we've been focused on trying to just do those things or fix those things, but really having any clean, tight data on what happens after high school, not so much. But I have seen some of our individual high schools do that. I want to say Carver Early College has done a good job of tracking that. I've seen, I know that we have two charter schools that have their first graduating classes coming up, and they already have some methods for tracking that. But there are some simple things that we can do, but it has to be an expectation that you set for not only the schools but the district, and that you hold yourself accountable for collecting those data. But I want to be clear, the district that has not had an accountability office, even after the cheating scandal, there's no accountability office, no clear department for research and evaluation, testing and compliance. And typically what you do, which is what we did in Austin, that's the standard practice of what they do. And a school doesn't have to go and count each one of their kids. The district does it for you, and you're able to follow students and and have more of a systemic approach, so you can think more about addressing what you said, like how do we make sure that when they enter college they don't have to take a semester of remedial courses. But I don't think there's anything consistent, at least I haven't seen it, what the board has, for how APS is doing it. But it is something I believe in, and I think we should do.
I think the questions get easier as we get later. Or I'd say the easier ones for later.
Yours should be medium.
I'm a Jerry Barber down the street. It says, what is the time frame for replacing Sarasota primary campus? I think maybe a better question, is there a time frame? I haven't seen the law schedule. Do you know whether there's
Okay, so, no, I don't. But this is what I said about those advisory committees, but this is the one that I want to oversight. Committee. So it'll be a very long acronym. Okay, it'll be very long. We've come up with another word. But what we did in Austin, I like this a lot. I think it is the only way to have any real accountability about these capital dollars. It was called a Citizen Bond Oversight Committee. And what they did wasn't on the front end. So like the district has needs and they can plan your facilities and where you need to make capital improvements and when a building's gonna be built and what property, blah, blah, blah. That happens on the front end. What I'm talking about happens is so people don't have questions like this. After the decision is made and we are breaking ground or whatever we need to do, you know, moving the kids so they can do a full renovation and so on and so forth. Whatever we're doing, the citizens and residents of this community need to come together in some kind of form to monitor that and speak to things like timelines, like before someone, who decides that it's delayed 6 months? I mean, I've heard this, like, the one school I think is about to go into its third year in Swing State. I went to visit it, and I was like, you just can't, because what APS does is, clearly I'm getting emotional about this one, but what APS does is like, it says, okay, you're going to do this, and this is going to take about a year. But people say, okay, because we're going to get a new school, or we're going to get a big new renovation. But then they don't do any renovations on or any improvements on the building you're in, and it really looks dumpy. I mean, there's hardly any sites that are like gorgeous swing sites, right? So it's a high school that you're putting middle school in, or the middle school that used to be a high school that we made it to an elementary school, but we're going to put a middle school in. So none of it really works. The spaces are terrible. You know, you didn't even hire your APs for the type of building you have, and the academic plan doesn't match the site at all. So you may be trying to be a great STEM school, but you have no great lab in the meantime. I mean, so these are things that I'm just observing. So what's happening is then that 1 year turns into 6 months, which then might turn into 2 years, and that's all one that's going on 3 years, and no one has an update. No one knows. Like, there's no regular reporting. So a bond oversight or some kind of SWOT oversight committee would allow people in the community to watch how the projects go, all of them, report back out to the community, allow people to attend those meetings, talk about everything from safety and security to the site. Did the contractors pay the minimum wage they were supposed to pay? Are, you know, historically underserved businesses being included in the bid? And goodness, the most important part, are we building on time? Are we on budget? You know, who, and if we're under budget, who gets the other money? What if, you know, if all this money goes into some kind of contingency fund, then what are we going to spend it on? If we have other needs, who gets first, second, and third priority? These are things that people like you could be helping us, like monitor and just be responsible for with the district. And so sometimes it is true. You may have to be 6 months delayed or a year delayed. Fine. But other people should be able to talk about it with confidence as well and explain that to the community. But right now, like, it's always a onesie. What's happening to this site or this school? And then if something does get pushed back, then what does that mean for the other stuff? And so there's, as a matter of fact, I've seen it so many times, I'm going to change my business before you find out. How's that? So yes, I made the charters yesterday. So tomorrow, I'm meeting with the people that are doing all this plant, this facility work, and having them. But I want them to go through the entire thing with me. I want to understand it. And whatever that is, we need to do a refresh on the website at minimum. I mean, they need to, like, tell people what is really going on with these different sites, renovations, new buildings, properties, and so on and so forth. And then I would say, I did a one-on-one today with the head and the COO and said, you know, here is what a charge looks like. Here are the areas. I'm not an expert in building stuff, but there's going to be unique things to Georgia. Lay them out. Let's get the thing put together, and let's go ahead and start establishing some kind of oversight committee that we can bring in and have them look at this work and report not only to the public and the, you know, the board, but, like, help us as an administration be held accountable to the promises we made with people's taxpayer dollars.
Is Sarah Smith even on the SPLOST construction project?
No.
Okay, well then that's conversation way down the road then. Because you've got phase three on SPLOST that isn't even being financed yet.
I thought you just meant, like, what Sarah
was. Specifically, what's happening at Sarah Smith's primary campus, or when is that going to something that we could have said something about that? Or replacing the primary campus.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah, said, what's the time frame for replacing the primary campus?
Yeah. I didn't hear that in the question. I thought you said, what was the time frame for? That's what I heard. I think it's like it's 62 years old.
Yeah.
So I wasn't saying we're replacing the school. I'm just saying we have a lot of old schools that, you know, need, like, tons of it. My thing is, what is the plan? Every school in a district has to be improved. There's like no common rhythm for, like, maintenance and things. I don't have to tell y'all about the HVAC problem, right? I mean, ask anybody to sit there with a spot cooler with all that noise at elementary kids. Very difficult to kind of, like, teach in here, although we got more quiet ones this year. But I'm just saying, like, it doesn't name any school. I mean, does anybody really know whether it's on the list for immediate improvement or later, you're going to need something sooner or later? What is the order? When is it being done? For the things that are actually scheduled, they need to be scheduled. And is there anything else that that we want to be planful for in the future? So if you want a school that's a top-notch, you know, fine arts school that, you know, is going to be the lead effort in the district in this area, and you want to build that out, then, you know, what's the plan? How do you know that it's going to get done? How do you know when it's going to get done? And if there's something on the table, like Sylvan Hills, that's going to get, I mean, they're one of the ones that's going to be in the building for a while. I went and looked at the site, and we should have, it hardly looks like we've broken ground. So, you know, this is a school that was expecting to kind of be in its new site. So that's what I was saying. It doesn't matter to me which school you name. we don't have a plan for how that gets, how we get held accountable for those kind of improvements.
Right.
Yes.
I think what the community has seen, and now there's three phases with the plot, and Clearsmith is not on the last phase. I think what you were saying is we're going to step back, refresh, and see what needs to be done across the district, but not to say that it wouldn't come up, but
right.
Just kind of prioritize
it. It was the greater question of where that threw all of us off. We're like, what are you talking about, Sarah? It wasn't you.
It was the bad question.
I got that question sent to me, and we haven't yet talked specific school to school, but that was on the list.
We've got two more questions. The first one's about class sizes. We've got 9 Title I schools here. And the elementary schools have maximum class size plus 5 of the state max. So what's your view on the importance of class size? Do you want to try and return it to the state max or at least lower than it is today?
Class size is one of those really complicated ones, and it just depends on the school, what the school has for funding, what the grade level of the school is. I could just go on and on. The heart of the class size conversation, you know, to me, by and large, the research is just mixed. Once you pass the early grade level, it's more about teacher quality. And I think on that part of the research, it is most clear. The early grades, I think we should try to get our class sizes down to the research-based levels, which would be lower than what I think the state recommends here. But you want to reduce them by like several students if you can. If that part they show, even with mixed teacher quality, the smaller class size does still make an academic difference for the better. Once you get past those grade levels, if you don't have a high quality teacher, you get the small class size you want, and so kids, you know, aren't going to be learning at the level that you want. Research doesn't support that. So now that doesn't mean I want to see 40 kids in a class, but I have been looking at grade level sizes. I mean, I went over to Brandon in particular because I heard a lot about that school. I went there at the beginning before the end of the school year to see it with kids really kind of going, and before we made the transition to the principalship. And then I went back in the first week of school to see it again. And, you know, and I'm constantly and carefully monitoring that, and actually have asked the principal, you know, to keep an eye and report to me class size before it starts tipping into something that is, you know, would be completely inappropriate. But the numbers are down, you know, below 30, more like 25, 26. We're going teacher by teacher in certain grade levels. And we all know that that's an issue, and I want to be very thoughtful and respectful to school communities that have those concerns. Again, I think for APS right now, and I don't remember all the details of the numbers, but I did talk to Errol Davis about it. I did ask him to run the numbers to me again. But if we went full hog and just said, for class size, we're doing this for the entire district, it's like a $22 million proposition, right? I mean, it's just, you can't afford it. But we can afford probably to do more in areas where we have gross overcrowding and be very specific and targeted about that, because those schools do not get Title I dollars, they don't get the extra resources, and knowing that APS does not spend its federal and state dollars in a timely fashion, often have to roll them over, and now, you know, we will lose tens of millions of dollars because of that behavior and funding, although and pretty begging not to do it this year and let me try to fix it. But those Title I schools do have a lot of extra resources. They need them. There is research that shows for children in high poverty with a great teacher and a smaller class size, it does pay off. But we have title dollars for them. I know we have not spent tens of millions of dollars we have not spent that can help those schools. And we need to, if that's what we're going to do, then we need to spend that money and let that be fit in those schools. What's happening is APS doesn't spend its grant dollars, so for schools who have high needs, you're taking even more money out of maintenance and operations to cover some of those things, and as a result, you still have even less for schools that are But there are some simple fixes we can do by cleaning up our expenditure practices. But as far as class size is concerned, I just want to be clear. Young grades, early grades, yes, we should be thoughtful about that across the entire district. When we get into the middle, I mean the upper elementary, middle, and high school, we want to nail teacher quality first, and then make sure that we're being careful about, you know, class sizes that are grossly overcrowded.
I'll just use this opportunity to put on my soapbox. Class size is a big issue for me. Brandon's third grade is 26 students, but he's state ranked plus 5. They get 4 more students, they're going to have to hire another teacher by law. What if they can't find a good one? You know, then we get stuck with one of those less than stellar teachers, which could have been avoided if we had smaller class sizes to begin with. I mean, is that something? I know you're aware of it, but.
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
you don't really,
I'm totally aware. No, I got it. And that's why, you know, I mean, we're still recruiting. I mean, we're going to recruit, like, we need teachers every single day in APS. I've got lots of national connections. I know the Woodrow Wilson School is doing another, Uber teacher kind of program, the super teacher kind of thing, and I will be talking to them about doing a direct partnership with Atlanta Public Schools. I just think we need more pathways for people that can bring the talent to the table out of the box, and others, but you know, none of these things will be perfect, and I just have a question for you. Did you write all these questions yourself, or did people really write these? Are these really? Okay, I just want to be sure. Like, did you put in your left hand and right and try to make the questions? Did you hand out the questions? Did you write this out for me?
This is the last question. I was thinking maybe we'd have Cynthia and Nancy have to answer it first. It's 2 parts. What do you think is the biggest challenge of the North Atlanta cluster? And the board members give those thoughts. And then the second part is, what are your initial thoughts on the central strategy?
I'm sorry,
I didn't
have that.
The second half is for Dr. Sarkar to answer.
Oh, I think there are several challenges, but one of the first one, I mean, we've talked about a few things. One of the biggest ones that comes to mind at the high school level is the rigor of classes and really getting kids to participate in the AP and the IB and take those tests and be successful on them. And that filters back down to the teacher and everything else that we've talked about. And I think there's been great headway made there. I think the fact that this is a cluster of IB, K-12, there's now continuous seeing those transition that will also help support that. The other big challenge that I think we have, and you know, this is going to come up and it's no secret, is our middle school capacity challenge. And that's something that we're going to have to address, and it's not going to be fun again. But, you know, we'll get there, and we have a lot of great things going on. But I think the academic rigor at the high school level, and how do we fit every kid in each building? We have Brandon Smith. We have 2 campuses at those schools, and other schools are, you know, getting bigger and bigger because the word is out. We've got great schools, so those I think are going to be our biggest challenge.
I would absolutely agree on the capacity issues. We've talked about those for a very long time. I would also add that we need to make sure that we don't lose those programs and those classes that have helped us build the IB program and helped us do that learning integration. That would be our foreign language programs and all of the efforts that we as a community have put into developing IB as what it is that makes us special. We need to, I'd like to see us do that. An IB coordinator at every school. We need to support those coordinators. And we need to make sure that they work together in the same way that our principals have been working together in order to ensure that seamless transition. I think everything we can do to strengthen that curriculum, that program, and that philosophy in this cluster improves the community, improves the cluster, and also allows us to act as a model for other clusters in APS that are beginning to build their own IB programs.
Because I feel we need to be very inclusive, and I want to recognize Matthew Kirby sitting in the back because we do have an additional school this school year, Atlanta Classical Academy, which is an IB, but it's part of this cluster and needs to, you know, join in the one of the families. So I wanted to recognize you.
Why don't you tell us what your perception of the biggest issue facing our planet? You can't use the answer to me. What's your third issue?
I don't know if it's the biggest issue. I just think there's just like a lot of misunderstanding between the North and the South. I think people have made a lot of judgments about each other and what people believe and care, and I was glancing over some of the questions, and like the word like affluent kept coming up, and I don't know how these things get projected to the rest of the community, but I don't know if it's a problem. I just think it's more of there's something that has created this tension between different geographic areas. And I think it's not just North Atlanta and South Atlanta. Even I've seen even schools where, you know, we close the school and merge schools, and these are people that almost live across the street from each other, but the line from the school just happens to be on this side versus that side. And they are actually almost in the exact same, they are in the same cluster, and there's tension about that. So I guess, I don't think it's just unique to North Atlanta, but I've just seen that I think the district will never be as great as it can be, and I don't think that North Atlanta will ever be as strong as it could be in South Atlanta or any of these other areas if we don't find a way to make decisions that are thoughtful enough to make every parent or family feel like they're really welcome and respected as a school community. And that means that, and I know that's maybe even not even a popular idea, but I feel so strongly about it that, I try to look just at the data of our need for our associate superintendents, and people would say to me, we want to have an expert for the North or the South. And it just seems to me we would just say, we want to have a back-to-school event for all of our families. We want, what is it that people need? Let's do that for Atlanta Public Schools. It just feels a lot like a system of individual schools, even within their own cluster, and not a school system. And that's fine. As a matter of fact, the state has come up with an operating model to fit that design. And if that's something that Atlanta really believes is the right direction, then I think instead, we need to kind of call it and plan for it. But I worry that if you in North Atlanta and others in South Atlanta and West and East don't say, like, we actually want a highly functioning, high quality Atlanta public school system, right, and not embrace that the district will continue, I think, to deteriorate. And I also think, as much as I do support charters, and I'm glad they're here and glad parents have those choices, I think that instead of it being something that, what I think the intent was, it's more for innovation, it's helping us with choice, it ends up being more of like, how are we pulling from other Atlanta public schools to just enroll or fund or create other sites for people to run into state to. And that, I would hope that we could get out of, and that, and I do have to hand it to Austin. It was incredible, like always, kind of the emotional, conversation when you went to the website, because people really did, they put their money where their mouth was, they put effort, and they teamed up, like literally sister schools with PTAs and other things that I think would make people like Thurgood Marshall and others really proud of what it would mean to be an American, for people holding out a hand for help in other parts of the city. But I think for North Atlanta, while I believe that people can help us with rigor, I think, you can get a solution from those schools.
school capacity, and he can hire IB coordinators, but it's really, it's got to be the heart and soul of our community that says North Atlanta is South Atlanta, and we are all APS, and how do we make the system better so that every part of the district is doing well and will be strong for it? And to me, that issue seems to surface more than any other academic issue, and that people don't understand each other and therefore won't respect each other, and that means kids won't either when they grow up to be your age.
I want to thank everybody for coming. I've got a seventh grader in public school, so I've been involved for about 8 years through the worst times, at least in recent memory. And I'm not exaggerating when we say Dr. Starkin is a breath of fresh air. I hope you all are excited about it. I hope that she needs it, you'll give her support. I want to really thank you for coming to see you.
Thank you.